This is Aspire, Arch Street Public Radio, broadcasting interviews from our Innovate podcast series.
My name is Robert Rim, Managing Editor for Arch Street Press. I'll be your host today.
Tim Zack is an Associate Teaching Professor and Director of the Institute for Social Innovation at Carnegie Mellon University. He spent over 25 years leading global organizations and advising executives in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors. Before joining CMU, Professor Zack was the founding CEO of the Social Innovation Accelerator, a private operating foundation providing seed capital and direct support for a portfolio of ventures focused on novel and financially sustainable ways to address social problems. Prior to launching the accelerator, he was a consultant in the business technology office at McKinsey and a leader in the firm's e-operations practice. And while at McKinsey, he served global clients in a variety of industries and focused on the development of new and technology-based ventures. Established in 2006 and housed at the Heinz College, Carnegie Mellon's Institute for Social Innovation is a multidisciplinary institute providing students, faculty, and researchers with a variety of applied learning opportunities to design, prototype, and launch financially sustainable ventures, projects, and policy initiatives that advance social innovation and entrepreneurship. Tim, good to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Tell us about the formation of the Institute for Social Innovation at Carnegie Mellon.
Well, in the middle part of the 2000s, there were a group of leaders, community leaders from Pittsburgh, from the nonprofit, government, for-profit, and philanthropic sectors that got together really quite frequently to assess nonprofit innovation and community impact, and specifically how social entrepreneurship and innovation might affect that. And of all the initiatives that were proposed and implemented by that group, in directly or indirectly, one of the suggestions one day was that if Pittsburgh was going to be known as a particularly innovative center for social impact, then it might be useful to have a university partner involved. And one of my colleagues at the Heinz College, our former associate dean, Brenda Pizer, I can distinctly remember, raised her hand and said, well, you know, I think Carnegie Mellon might be interested in that. And that led to, not surprisingly, quite a bit of planning about what a university partner might look like. And it started with a concentration at the graduate level in social innovation and entrepreneurship, which I think at the time in about 2005 or 2006 was among just a handful of similar sorts of concentrations in universities, really anywhere in the world. And from there, expanded into a variety of initiatives, really providing a platform for students, staff, and faculty at the university to engage in social innovation and entrepreneurship in some way or form.
And Pittsburgh, as you well know, our listeners may or may not, has had a very long history of innovation, of economic success, of economic hardship. Was the Institute's development spurred on by the economic comeback going on in Pittsburgh at the time?
I think there was a sense that certain trends were starting to work in the city's favor. I think it was perhaps in the prior 5 or 10 years that we started to get a more robust startup environment and ecosystem just in the city in general. And I think that there was just a general sense that Pittsburgh was becoming more entrepreneurial and innovative, and why not consider those effects to occur when thinking about community and economic development and other issues related to social problems that exist in Pittsburgh and a bunch of other cities around the world.
And you mentioned how you became affiliated with Carnegie Mellon. What do you feel is higher education's role in general in social innovation?
Well, there are naturally some things that colleges and universities do well, and there are some things that they probably shouldn't do too much of. What universities do well, not surprisingly, are educate people. Hopefully we do that well. And so I think there are opportunities to provide, at a minimum, awareness, if not in-depth investigation of this whole field, this whole domain area now of social entrepreneurship and innovation, which quite frankly didn't really even exist as a university course really until the middle part of the 1990s when my friend and colleague, the late Greg Dees, taught the first class at Harvard. So at least one of the roles is to educate our students and other interested parties about what this field is all about, give them exposure to the extent that they would like to have it and have an appetite for it. I also think that universities are good for research, and in this particular field, I think applied research, those things that are trying to marry theory and concept to actual practice in the world, I think is particularly important in this domain area. And then maybe the third thing is just as a convener of parties and to have sort of a neutral role in bringing together a variety of stakeholders in the community that might be focused on a particular social issue, and to convene that group and perhaps facilitate a discussion in a way that seems non-threatening to parties that may have really different ideas about how to move forward.
And beyond Carnegie Mellon, have you seen higher education's approach to social entrepreneurship really evolving over the last decade, both in the United States and throughout the world?
Well, it has completely exploded. I recall when we were trying to plan out what the Institute for Social Innovation might actually do, we did a pretty comprehensive, I think, global view of other colleges and universities that were engaged in this activity in some way, and honestly, it was a relative handful. And now if you did that same sort of analysis 10 or close to 15 years later, there are literally hundreds of colleges and universities around the world that have a focus in some way in this particular area. And so it has really grown enormously over the past 10 or 15 years. In the early 2000s or the mid-2000s, I would liken it almost to where entrepreneurship was in the United States in the, let's say, the late 1960s or 1970s, when if you told your mom you were an entrepreneur, she'd probably ask why you were speaking French. You know, we really didn't know what those people were. I mean, they existed. Of course, they've existed for decades or even hundreds of years, but it really wasn't the way that we recognize entrepreneurship today. And so in some ways, I guess it's not that surprising, there's a little bit of a parallel trajectory between entrepreneurship, 40 years ago and where social entrepreneurship is today.
C'est absolument la vérité.
You've already passed my 2 years of high school French right there, so nothing more to add.
And it's been wonderful to see how young people these days have taken not only to entrepreneurship itself, but to social entrepreneurship. And there's a real desire not only to enhance their business acumen, but to make a difference in society. Have you seen this directly, and do you find this with your students that you work with?
Well, I think one of the biggest changes that's occurred over the last 10 or 15 years in the interactions that I've had with students at Carnegie Mellon is, and I can almost put a dividing line between when I left to start up our campus in Australia, which was really difficult duty, as you can imagine, but in 2007, and I returned in 2010. And prior to 2007, in my courses in social enterprise and entrepreneurship, students were primarily interested in launching nonprofits with a very strong mission-based focus, perhaps not considering very much the financial sustainability components of what they were proposing. And when I returned in 2010, so just a few years ago, one of the biggest shifts were students that were now focused on for-profit social ventures, very much focused on how financial sustainability played a role not only in allowing the organization to exist and continue, but perhaps how that actually reinforced the social mission and provided a multiplier effect for social impact to actually occur. So I think students across the spectrum of awareness to perhaps even wanting to launch ventures and become social entrepreneurs has grown tremendously. And we see a lot of that activity occurring in even disciplines that we wouldn't have considered, let's say, a decade ago. I have now in my social innovation incubator classes and some other coursework, students from fine arts, from, drama school, from, not surprisingly, perhaps the School of Engineering, a whole variety of programs that we have on campus that, again, a decade ago, maybe we wouldn't have considered as being viable disciplines or degree programs for social entrepreneurs. But we continue to be surprised.
And why Australia? And what takeaways were key for you in shaping your approach to the Institute?
We launched degree programs at Carnegie Mellon in specifically in South Australia, in Adelaide. And it was part of a continuing effort on behalf of the university to expand its scope beyond our main campus in Pittsburgh. We think that we are an institution that can have global impact. And obviously not all things that happen in the globe are, you know, happen in Pittsburgh or are even recognized in Pittsburgh. And so I think our intention was, if we intend to have global impact, then we should at least have certain presence in the world. We should do that specifically with partners. And we did that in very strong partnership with the both state and the Commonwealth governments in Australia. And South Australia in particular is a very interesting place because it is at least billed as the driest state in the driest country in the world. You know, that's a area where just necessarily a lot of innovations related to the environment, for example, clean and plentiful water, is of utmost importance. And so for our students that are interested in those sorts of activities and, you know, want to get a different view of what happens in different places in the world, depending on their interests, having a university presence in a different part of the world can be very beneficial.
And you mentioned partnerships. How important is collaboration to social entrepreneurship?
Well, I think it is just as important as it is when it comes to entrepreneurship in general. And, you know, I'd already referred to my friend Greg Dees. He is kind of famous for the quote that's saying, you know, entrepreneurship is just one species of the genus entrepreneur. So, you know, I think of this broader umbrella of all entrepreneurship. And we have this notion that of the lone entrepreneur, right, that through force of will and innovation and charisma launches a venture that ends up changing the world. And that's really a myth in almost every case. I think you could point historically to every successful entrepreneur and you would see a variety of partnerships, not only with individuals, but with organizations that expand their scope and their capabilities and their ability to scale and their ability to have more impact. For social entrepreneurs, it might even be more important because you're not dealing just with your ability to make money, which for entrepreneurs, the indications of success are pretty straightforward. Did I make a profit or not? For social entrepreneurs, you're focusing very heavily on what are likely very vexing social problems, of which many other people and organizations have taken a crack at. And there's lots of good and viable ideas out there and expertise. And so certainly the notion of the lone entrepreneur for a social entrepreneur probably increases the risk of failure even more than their for-profit counterpart.
And as someone whose career includes time in both the academic and private sectors, what similarities and differences have you seen in approaches to social entrepreneurship?
Well, I think not surprisingly, in an academic setting, we have a tendency to theorize and conceptualize and study perhaps a little bit more than, a for-profit entrepreneur would. An entrepreneur or any sort of a for-profit venture in the private sector is focused, very heavily focused on a day-to-day basis on what is happening on the ground, what's happening in the real world. However, those two domains certainly have crossover. If we're being smart about how we think about our academic programs related to social entrepreneurship, then we're very much focused on reaching out to communities through maybe even specific projects, which we have here at Carnegie Mellon, or applied research initiatives. And likewise, in the for-profit space, only focusing on day-to-day activities without a broader, longer perspective of strategy and perhaps even theory, depending on where you're involved, is a bit short-sighted. So there are certainly some differences, and differences with good reason, but there's also enough similarities to see where there are some interesting crossovers.
And has one sector informed or changed the perspective of the other?
Well, it's an interesting question. I think that increasingly academic programs are driven by practicality. Perhaps, you know, a century or two ago, you had a very small subset of a population that even could go to a university and study. And the intention was to put them in a position to be in a very exalted place in society. And clearly in many parts of the world, and particularly the United States, that I think that view of the role of universities has changed. We're much more, I think, practically focused on putting our students in a position where they can be successful in the future. And in the short term, that might be allowing them to get their first job. But hopefully over time, that is, you know, giving them the tools in the toolbox to continue to be successful and to continue to learn over time. So I think that we learn a lot from what happens in the private sector simply because we need to make our programmatic areas as practical as they can be and as formative as they can be. And so in some ways, academics probably get influenced more by what happens in the private sector than vice versa.
And are there challenges for you working within a larger university body, in this case, Carnegie Mellon?
I think that there are always challenges because you've got a very wide variety of disciplines. We certainly do here at Carnegie Mellon. We've got everything from an absolute world-class fine arts program with former Academy Award winners and Tony Award winners and Grammy Award winners to our School of Business, which is very highly ranked, to one of the one or two top computer science programs in the entire country. So we've got an incredible diversity of student, staff, and faculty, and therefore thinking and perspective on different things. And so there's just inherent challenges in being in an institution that has that kind of diversity. On the other hand, although I haven't been directly employed, at least by another institution, what I am told by other people is that at Carnegie Mellon, our silos probably aren't nearly as high. The permeability between different disciplines is really quite good. And I think that's just fundamental to the culture that we had here that was developed from the beginning, part of Andrew Carnegie's intent when he provided the initial endowment for the college, now university, was to be multidisciplinary, was to be innovative. And I think we recognize that being able to cross disciplines and work very readily with our colleagues across the university can be really beneficial. And we certainly see that in the number of entrepreneurial ventures that spin out of Carnegie Mellon every year relative to our size or relative to our research funding, which, again, relative to most other universities and colleges, is very, very high.
This episode of Innovate is brought to you by 19th Street Press and Queen of Angels, the debut novel from David Castro. Queen of Angels contrasts Shakespeare with gritty, profane 70s New York. Not only is the novel a compelling exploration of young love, it's a gripping piece of storytelling, says Publishers Weekly. Queen of Angels by David Castro from 19th Street Press.
And talking about different disciplines, you also come from a tech background with a master's in engineering science with concentrations in manufacturing systems and reliability from the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. How has your education experience impacted your leadership role?
Oh, well, I think in a variety of ways. I guess the other component is that I went to Carnegie Mellon as an undergrad, and I somehow found my way through the first 2 years of the computer science program, and after a pretty large cutdown, I was still there. And I realized that I wouldn't be the best programmer in the world for sure, but maybe I could be the boss of all the programmers. And so I got a double major at the business school. And so between computer science and business, and as you mentioned, engineering, I at least have a relatively broad perspective on a variety of different disciplines, certainly within the technology space and in a place like Carnegie Mellon that does have a very diverse set of academic offerings, and the role of technology and social entrepreneurship. I think knowing a reasonable amount about, you know, a fairly large number of things is helpful, if for no other reason, but because I might be able to make some connections between individuals or different kinds of projects, or at least through pattern recognition, see some opportunities for social entrepreneurs to do some things that perhaps they wouldn't have been able to see before.
And you mentioned Carnegie Mellon's business school, obviously one of the top ranked in the country, and you were very fortunate to be able to shift seamlessly from one school to the other. And you also mentioned silos, and we see this repeatedly, how detrimental they are. Do you see any kind of meaningful breakdown in the silos that continue to happen within universities and also within the business world?
Well, from a university perspective, I think our students actually are increasingly demanding it because their interests are so vast and so broad. It's really interesting. You know, we're very lucky here at Carnegie Mellon to have the opportunity to recruit students from literally around the world. And students, particularly, maybe it's specific to this generation, maybe it isn't, but certainly what I see are students who have a vast variety of interests. And so while they may exist in a particular school or college on this campus or others, they're forcing us in a good way, the faculty, to understand these different kinds of disciplines, to reach out across different parts of the university, to find other colleagues that we can collaborate with. For example, I teach a class jointly with our School of Design. And I have a great colleague who is a professor in the School of Design. And I'm certainly not an expert on design, and she's not an expert on policy. But between the two of us, we put forth a course that we think is relatively unique and well-positioned on having social impact that intersects those two disciplines. And it probably wouldn't happen unless we would have gotten a lot of feedback from our respective student bodies saying, you know, I'd really like to know and understand more about that. And in many ways, because you mentioned the private sector, that sort of thinking is at the core of innovation. We often think that innovation solely derives from, let's say, starting point of basic research, where you have a sole scientist or an engineer in a laboratory, and they make a certain discovery, and it goes through kind of a linear process, ultimately becoming a product or service, and that's how we get new things out into the world. And the reality is that innovation is very messy. It often requires the inputs of lots of different people with lots of different ideas that have all kinds of different backgrounds. And that sort of messy process is often how really big breakthroughs occur. So the academic environment, I think, mimics the private sector, and even in some places, the nonprofit and the public sector, in ways where entrepreneurship and innovation seems to flourish.
And about the student perspective, you've got a great student project incubator. It's called the Idea Lab. Tell us about it.
Well, we have a number of different incubation programs across campus. And I think part of what's interesting is that increasingly more of those sorts of programs are welcoming ventures that have a dual purpose, or maybe even more than two purposes, of both social impact and financial sustainability. We might even include, you know, things like environmental impact into that as well. And so our incubator and others around campus really are just taking different views and perspectives on the same central idea, which is how can we take interesting concepts at this intersection between financial sustainability and social impact and cultivate them in ways such that perhaps in this relative safe space of a university, those ideas that seem like a good idea at the time, but really turn out to be not viable, perhaps at this time or at any other, can be wound down before they go out into the real world and, you know, take up a lot of time and money and energy of a lot of other people, but also to support those that should spin out of the university and enter into perhaps other sorts of similar incubation programs or get direct funding or just start to spin out on their own. So the incubation efforts that we have are not surprisingly very focused on social entrepreneurship and innovation, but honestly, probably 80 to 90% of the material that we introduce students to, of the way that we take them through the process, would be very similar to what you would see in a comparable entrepreneurship development, sort of an incubator at, let's say, our Tepper School of Business.
And your students must be aware that you've worn many hats over the course of your career. Are there one or two key aspects that have driven your professional life and that actually enable students to relate maybe more closely to one aspect or another?
You know, it's kind of interesting that you mentioned that. I was asked to give a talk, this was some number of years ago, to a group of students. And what the organizers had hoped that I would present would be sort of how I got to be such a great success. And I put that in quotes. And the central message that I had, that I started right from the very beginning, is that when I exited Carnegie Mellon, I had this whole plan sort of worked out where eventually I would become the CEO of IBM, which is where I started my career. And it became apparent within probably the first, maybe it was even the first couple of weeks, but certainly the first few months, that, you know, my plan was going to have to take a whole bunch of other new twists and turns. And it sort of reminds me of probably my favorite quote of all time from former heavyweight champion Mike Tyson, right? He said, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face.
Yes.
And, so, you know, I think my central message was that you really can't plan it all out, that you pursue the things in the moment that seem to be interesting, that you're curious about, that provide you with particular opportunities. And if at each step of the way you think you're making the best, most reasoned sort of decisions that you can to optimize this balance between your curiosity, the practical demands that you have to, you know, make money or perhaps support your family, and other kinds of considerations, maybe related to ambition or whatever drives you individually, then at least you have the opportunity to look back at some point and say, well, I don't really have any regrets. There are some things that might have gone better or some things that went not as well as I would have hoped. But at least every moment at opportunity, I tried to take what I thought was the best path. I was willing to take some risks. But in the end, if you do enough of that, you can look back a little bit and say, if you choose to do that, and say, no regrets. It's turned out the way that it turned out. And, I should be satisfied with however that got me to the point that I'm at now.
And you talked about curiosity, and it's always interesting how some people reach a certain point in life where they've had a measure of success, and they feel that they don't have to or they don't want to continue to learn any further. And there are other people who get into their 80s and 90s and who get up each day eager to learn new things. What causes such a difference in people as far as curiosity goes?
Well, that's a good question. You know, it's probably, as is true with many things, a portion of what drives you is genetic, and a portion of what drives you is environmental, right? The context under which you operate in. And so, you know, there may be some people that perhaps just don't have the curiosity gene, or, you know, it's not as prominent. There may be some people that over the course of their, earlier or even adult lives, just weren't in a context where curiosity was rewarded, or it was not something that was very prominent for them. And of course, the inverse is true. And so we almost look at that as, curiosity is so critical and important. For some people, maybe they can live perfectly happy lives without always having to pursue the next thing, without always having to learn the new thing. But I think no matter what, almost everybody is learning something as they continue through life. Sometimes it's big and sometimes small. So I think there's probably a variety of drivers. There's this term in geriatric studies called squaring the curve, which is, can you live at a high level of performance and functionality pretty much right up until the very point that you pass away, as opposed to having this long, slow decline? And my hypothesis is that those people who are curious and interested in the world probably square the curve a little bit better than the average person in the population.
And curiosity is surely rewarded with social entrepreneurship. Are there any long-term projects that you'd like to share that you've planned at the Institute?
Well, I think our primary focus, and certainly will be for the foreseeable future, will be something that you had referred to earlier in the interview, which is continuing to integrate the different disciplines across the university together so that not only can we launch more ventures and hopefully spin out new things into the world, but that our researchers and faculty can find even more intersections for interesting research opportunities. And, you know, in some ways, we're already starting to see that. The ISI is not, while the ISI has to have a physical home, and it does in the Hines College, which is one of the seven schools and colleges at CMU, it is the university's Institute for Social Innovation and Entrepreneurship. So part of what we're trying to do is identify and seed and facilitate these sort of, you know, interactions. And if they occur on their own, that's good too. But we're starting to see even more and more of our research as a university focused on things that could be classified as socially impactful. We're seeing more and more ventures that have at least that sort of component. And I think you get a significant multiplicative effect if you can continue to meld and integrate different disciplines and different sorts of ideas together. I think that's probably the biggest concerted impact and initiative that we have in the foreseeable future.
It's a fascinating intersection. And on that note, listeners can find out more about Tim and Carnegie Mellon's Institute for Social Innovation by clicking on the links next to this podcast. Again, Tim, good to have you with us today, and we wish you much continued success with your vital work in social innovation.
Very good. Thanks again very much for having me.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources are available at our website, innovatepodcast.org. Aspire and Innovate are produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and by Arch Street Press. For PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.